studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising, and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Thursday, September 3rd, 2015. Fossil fuel companies pay their CEOs so obscenely that it's driving them to put the planet in peril. We'll speak with Sarah Anderson, author of a new report on oil, gas, and coal CEO pay. And Marjorie Cohn joins us to warn against a future involving drones armed with weapons in the United States. Plus, a federal judge has severely restricted the use of solitary confinement in California prisons. We'll be joined live in studio by Cruz Gallegos. She is the sister of an inmate. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Chenjerai Kumanyika. He's an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University. The body of a drowned Syrian Kurdish toddler washed up on the beach of a Turkish resort has sparked widespread outrage. 3-year-old Aylan Kurdi was identified after he and his brother and mother drowned, attempting to flee the brutal Syrian war. The Kurdi family had applied to enter Canada, but their application had encountered problems, and so they boarded a boat to head for Greece, but the boat capsized. The father is the only survivor. Meanwhile, in Hungary, thousands of refugees remain trapped at a train station in Budapest, desperate to leave the country so they can head toward other nations like Germany. The Hungarian government has come under fire internationally for not allowing the refugees to leave, but claiming they don't want them to stay. European leaders are struggling to come to an agreement about how to handle the refugee crisis from North Africa and the Middle East, but ordinary Europeans have taken to social media saying they welcome refugees. Well, Chenjerai, the photos of Aylan Kurdi are just unbearable to look at. Will they at last push governments to come to terms with the problem?
Well, you know, the question is, you know, what are they going to do? And there's different viewpoints on what they should do, very different viewpoints. Unfortunately, where you've had a string of right-wing parties coming to power in various places in Europe, the solutions they're recommending are things like building walls and, in some ways, very similar to the kind of rhetoric we hear out of the conservative right in America or in the United States. But you also have, from the Syriza party in Greece, a much more solidarity-based, approach. But I also think that we really, you look at this tragic case of this child. We have to go back a year ago to the Strengthening Canadian Citizenship Act passed last year, which really, treats citizenship as a privilege and not a right. And I'm sure was not unrelated to Canada's decision to deny the refugee request placed by this family. So these things that are framed as current crises actually have long, deep roots.
In Guatemala, President Otto Perez Molina has just resigned and will now face legal charges in a corruption scandal. On Tuesday, the Guatemalan Congress stripped Mr. Molina of immunity, paving the way for the charges. The scandal involves a customs fraud scheme. Mass protests throughout the country, but especially in Guatemala City, had paved the way for this moment. According to the New York Times, quote, Guatemala City's middle class, long reluctant to speak out after a brutal civil war, demonstrated the costs of opposition, joined forces with peasant and indigenous groups. Molina's resignation comes just days before a general election on Sunday. The leading candidate in the polls is a wealthy businessman who has links to Molina and is also implicated in corruption scandals. An electoral tribunal defied popular demands to postpone the election. Well, Chenjerai, could ordinary Guatemalans shape their democracy through these popular protests?
Well, I think we have a really encouraging example of groups coming together. As we said before, we know that Guatemala is deeply divided by class, race, and so forth. But what we saw here was students from the country's three top private universities joined students from the state-funded University of San Carlos, and they got together with religious groups, gay rights organizations, and other citizens, and just staged weeks of peaceful protest. So that protest really played a role in pressing them to figure out what was going on.
And we are going to get Chenjerai back on with us. Can you hear us, Chenjerai? Okay, we're going to call him right back. He was just finishing up his answer on the situation in Guatemala, where the president there has resigned and there will be charges. There will be a general election on Sunday. Finally, here in the United States, the Obama administration is cautiously celebrating a major foreign policy victory after tallying up enough votes to secure passage of the U.S.-Iran nuclear deal. Secretary of State John Kerry, who's personally participated in the the months-long negotiations gave a speech in Philadelphia soon after it became public that the vote would pass. He said, quote, every threat to Israel and to our friends in the region would be more dangerous if Iran were permitted to have a nuclear weapon, referring to the fact that the greatest opposition to the deal stemmed from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He added, quote, the Iran agreement is not a panacea for the sectarian and extremist violence that has been ripping that region apart, but history may judge it a turning point, a moment when the builders of stability seized the initiative from the destroyers of hope. End of quote. Well, Chandra, groups like MoveOn.org and Code Pink have been rallying over the past week in support of the deal. How important is this?
Well, I think it's important. You know, when we look at what the alternatives are here, which is the military option that many here on the conservative side would love us to pursue in Iran, and you also look at, you know, the way that this deal may form unity that will help a variety of countries, sort of coalition of countries, to collectively address the problems in the Middle East. What Code Pink has done is show how those issues particularly affect women and how women have particular stakes, or those interested in women, really all of us have particular stakes, and they're uniquely affected by situations of war and by the conditions of the Middle East. And that particular narrative doesn't always get drawn out by the larger frame. So I think they played an important role in that regard.
Chandra, thank you as always for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you very much.
Chandrai Kumanyika is an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University and our daily Newsflash guest expert on Thursdays. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The reality of climate change is hitting more and more Americans each day, with the Gulf Coast's hurricanes, California's drought, Washington's wildfires, and much more. Even President Obama, who has approved permits for Shell to drill for oil in the Arctic, realizes he has to pay lip service to curbing climate change. He's just wrapped up a 3-day trip to Alaska to visit communities on the front lines of rising sea levels. But one group of Americans seems unfazed by the coming apocalypse, and that's the people directly responsible for a relentless corporate push to exploit greenhouse gas-emitting fossil fuels in the name of profit. A new study by the Institute for Policy Studies has found that CEO compensation in the fossil fuel industries is obscene, even compared to other major money-making sectors in the economy. My guest is Sarah Anderson. She is the Global Economy Project Director at IPS, and she is the lead author of the report entitled Executive Excess 2015, Money to Burn. Welcome to Uprising, Sarah.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Now, your study specifically examined the 30 largest publicly held U.S. oil, gas, and coal companies. How much do their CEOs make, and how does their compensation compare to others in similarly profitable industries?
Well, what we found is CEOs at these 30 companies made about $14.7 million on average last year, and that was 9% above what are already obscenely paid average CEOs of big companies in America makes.
So $14 million each on average?
That's correct. And we are looking at some big companies here, but overall, the market value of these companies was even a little bit lower than the S&P 500 average. So doing damage to the climate is very lucrative for people at the top of these companies.
And how are they paid? What is their pay structure like? I mean, you know, we get those, the 99% of us who are, you know, would never see $1 million perhaps in our lifetime. We get a paycheck once or twice a month, and it's usually pay in our bank account. How are CEOs getting paid?
Well, the majority of their compensation is some form of stock-based pay. So either stock options, which expand in value if the value of the stock goes up, or just flat out stock grants. And what our criticism is that encourages a real fixation on pumping up the stock price in the short term, because in turn, that'll inflate the paychecks of these executives. And this is a problem throughout corporate America. But when you're talking about companies that have such potential to do so much damage to billions of people around the world, it's even more dangerous.
I'm imagining what we could do with all that money that's going to pay these CEOs, what we could do to combat climate change. Now, you engaged in that thought experiment in your report, right?
That's exactly true. And we did that because I think for so many people, the issue of climate change can be so overwhelming, and the costs that are thrown around about, you know, what we would need to spend in order to combat this problem can seem very overwhelming. But when you break it down and put it in the perspective of how much are the people who are helping to drive this climate crisis making, you see a different picture. So the big fat number in our report is $6 billion. That's how much the top management teams at these 30 companies have made over the past 5 years. So $6 billion, what could you do with that? Well, you could, for example, double the pledge that the Obama administration has made to help vulnerable countries around the world address climate change. You could create 100,000 new green energy jobs in the U.S. You could help 3.3 million low-income families weatherize their houses and reduce their energy bills. So we hope that some of the figures we came up with help put these costs in perspective.
Now, if fossil fuel companies had long-term vision, they would realize that they are at the helm of an industry that is in decline. I mean, if there's no planet, if our planet doesn't have a future, how can oil and gas have a future, right? How does the CEO pay structure as it is today encourage short-term thinking?
Well, it's just incredibly perverse. So we looked at all of the big oil companies, and at each one of them, when it comes to bonus time to decide how much the big annual cash bonus should be, at each of them, they looked at whether the CEO had been successful in expanding their carbon reserves, even though these companies are already sitting on so much carbon that they own, that if it was fully burned, it would lead to a climate catastrophe. So that's the kind of totally perverse incentives that we're seeing here. And then that on top of the bulk of their pay, as I said, comes in the form of these stock options and stock grants. So if they can bump up their pay, their stock prices in the short term and cash in, they'll get out before the impacts of the climate change that they're helping to create ever really kick in. And some of the most outrageous examples in our report are in the coal sector, which is already imploding. A lot of these companies are really going into the ground now, which in a way, it's a really positive thing for the environment that regulations and other reasons why there's declining demand have put these companies into crisis. But what's disgusting is to see how the executives cashed in and plundered these companies before they started to implode. At Alpha Natural Resources, for example, that's one of the big coal companies, and it just filed for bankruptcy, their executives cashed in $33 million in stock options before things started to go downhill for them. Another one, Peabody Energy, which is just barely hanging on with its stock trading around $2 per share. They likewise, the CEO cashed in about $26 million before hard times hit. So whatever's going on in the broader world, these executives always seem to reap huge windfalls.
So is it then safe to say that the nature of CEO pay in this industry is accelerating climate change?
Absolutely. It's not, you know, the only reason why we're having so much trouble responding to the climate challenge, but it is one obstacle. You know, President Obama has been out there urging a faster transition to renewable energy. And up in Alaska, he talked about underinvestment in solar and wind alternative energy sources. Well, there is no incentive for these big fossil fuel company executives to lead that shift. And when it came up at the ExxonMobil annual meeting this year, a shareholder asked the CEO, Rex Tillerson, you know, what about investing in renewables? He just mocked him. I mean, it was just, you know, complete disdain for that. And we argue that both for the, you know, the health of the planet and the people live on it, but also for the long-term health of these companies, it makes all the sense in the world to start making that shift. But the incentives are just not there for the executives.
So let's talk about Rex Tillerson, CEO of ExxonMobil, pocketed, in according to your report, he pocketed $33 million in 2014, so well above that $14 million average, raising his total compensation over the past 5 years to $165 million. That's incredible. How do you put that into context in terms of ExxonMobil's responsibility for driving climate change? Are they the largest company in the world today?
They are the largest U.S. fossil fuel company. I think Shell and BP are, you know, rivals with them, but they're certainly the largest in the U.S. And, you know, when I started doing this report, I started thinking, you know, how is ExxonMobil going to respond to this? Or are they going to throw a lot of greenwashing at me and claim they really are investing a lot in renewables, and how do I prepare for that argument? No, they're not even pretending to be diversifying their portfolio. They are, you know, 100% on the fossil fuel bandwagon, and Tillerson has no plans, it seems to me, to be changing that at all. Another just outrageous thing that's been going on at ExxonMobil that we raise up in the report is that the company has been trying to artificially increase the value of their share price by buying back their own company shares. So you buy those from the marketplace, it reduces the number, and that should bump up your share price. In turn, of course, that pumps up the value of Tillerson's own pay package. So it's a way to continue to bloat the pay packages of these fossil fuel executives. And ExxonMobil spent $13.4 billion on these stock buybacks last year. Another crazy juxtaposition is that that amount of money could have doubled all corporate spending on renewable energy research and development that year. So it's about priorities. You know, companies used to take a huge share of their profits and invest it in innovative research, and all these companies are, you know, using it to prop up their own shares and their own executives' paychecks.
And of course, when the waters begin rising, they will have the money to build the arcs. So you've been studying CEO pay for a long time. Are there trends that you can point to in CEO pay for fossil fuel companies over the years?
Well, like with most companies, the real shift has been towards having the majority of the compensation be in the form of the stock-based pay. And the argument there was that it would align the interests of the executives with the interests of shareholders, and that this would somehow ensure pay for performance. They would only get paid a lot of money if they were performing well and the stock was doing well. And instead, it has really encouraged this fixation on the short-term stock gains. These kinds of stock payouts, you can cash in after only about 3 or 4 years. And, you know, corporate boards will say, well, that is long term. We know that's not long term, especially when you're talking about the impact of climate change, which plays out over decades. So they can do all kinds of shenanigans in the short term that'll bump up the shares and their own paychecks, but will have disastrous long-term effects.
So Sarah, what then needs to be done to reform CEO pay structures in this industry? And could reforming the structure actually curb the damage being done to the planet?
I think it's one thing that needs to happen. It's not obviously the only thing. There's going to need to be a lot of different strategies to really turn this around. But when it comes to CEO pay, I think there are a couple of things that are obvious. One is, you know, please get rid of these bonus incentives that reward executives for expanding their carbon reserves and for executing fossil fuel projects, no matter what the damage is to the rest of the world. I mean, we have examples in the report of executives who get an increase in their bonus because they're pushing through tar sands projects and, you know, just the most damaging of all the fossil fuel kinds of development. And then secondly, getting at the short-term issue, like I said, usually they can cash in their stock pay after 3 to 4 years. We've got to extend that to at least 10 to 15 years and make it stick, even if an executive retires during that time, because otherwise they're stuck in that short-term time horizon. And for the, you know, survival of the planet, we need to get them to think longer term.
Sarah, where can people find out more about the report and actually read the report itself?
Yeah, well, it should be on our homepage at the Institute for Policy Studies, and our website is ips-dc.org.
And we'll post a link to uprisingwithsonali.com later today. Again, that website, ips-dc.org. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest, Sarah Anderson, is the Global Economy Project Director at the Institute for Policy Studies and the lead author of the report, Executive Excess 2015, Money to Burn. This is Uprising. When we come back, we'll take a look at the future possibility of drones in the United States equipped with so-called non-lethal weapons. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. In the past year, debates have raged about the militarization of police and the weapons they've deployed against Americans. Despite public outrage over the scenes of activists in Ferguson and Baltimore being met with tear gas, a new and even more sinister possibility is developing. Just as the planners of foreign wars have switched from ground troops to drone bombs, police here in the United States may soon send unmanned aerial vehicles armed with so-called non-lethal weapons to control crowds and protests. The state of North Dakota earlier this year was the first state to legalize the use of armed drones by police. Writing about this disturbing development and what it means for the future of policing is Marjorie Cohn. She's a professor of human rights at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and editor of the book Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Welcome to Uprising, Marjorie.
My pleasure, Sonali.
Now, can you explain what exactly North Dakota legalized, since they seem to be sort of on the front lines of this very scary sounding trend? They want to put weapons on drones that could be remotely operated?
Well, they call them less than lethal weapons. So they include rubber bullets, tasers, sound cannons, tear gas, pepper spray. But in fact, these types of non-lethal, supposedly non-lethal weapons can actually result in injury or death. And in fact, UN Special Rapporteur Christoph Hines says that rubber bullets, water cannons, and tear gas have caused injury and death. And he is concerned that law enforcement may argue, well, these are less than lethal, so we don't have to assess what level of force is appropriate. But at least 39 people have been killed this year with tasers. And also, he is concerned, this is the UN Special Rapporteur Haynes, that an armed drone controlled by a human from a distance cannot really substitute for what police officers are supposed to do, which is to use minimum force under the circumstances.
So we are, you know, basically envisioning what is happening in other countries. to be happening here in the United States. Now, drones have ordinarily in countries like Yemen, Pakistan, Afghanistan, etc., been used for both actually killing people, but also surveilling people, actually spying on them. And there's been talk of drones doing that here in the U.S., particularly near the U.S.-Mexico border. What do law enforcement here in the U.S., whether they're federal level or local, want to do with drones specifically? Are they looking just to weaponize them, also spy on people?
Well, the Customs and Border Patrol is surveilling about half, almost half of the U.S.-Mexico border with drones. They're extremely expensive. And in fact, they've only resulted in apprehending less than 0.1% of all undocumented immigrants who are actually apprehended. So it's a tremendous expense. And they eventually will probably want to, I mean, there has been some talk by the Customs and Border Patrol of using these less than lethal weapons eventually, when the public dialogue about it dies down a little. I can see them asking for lethal drones, especially if they say, well, we are trying to prevent crime at the border and people are coming over and committing robberies and maybe even homicides, etc. I can see that that's where they're headed. Hmm.
So what are the laws governing drones in the United States? Is there sort of a delay because this technology is so new that loopholes exist within which law enforcement are rushing to work?
Yes, that's true. They are. And in fact, there are bills pending in about 26 states have bills regulating how drones can be used, but and some of these have to do with the use of a warrant. But there are actually two bills now pending in Congress, one in the Senate, one in the House, which would require the use of search warrants by law enforcement before they use drones. I mean, surveillance is they need warrants to do any kind of search or seizure, with a few exceptions, but especially long-term surveillance where the technology is such that they can detect the most minute detail about our lives, I think should certainly require warrants. Now, the Supreme Court has not weighed in on this either, although I can't imagine that they won't in the next couple of years. There are some precedents in the Supreme Court that we can look to and that the Supreme Court will clearly look to when they decide whether or not to require a warrant. There was a case some time ago called California versus Cirallo. And in that case, the Supreme Court upheld the warrantless use of a fixed-wing aircraft at an altitude of 1,000 feet to peer into a private fenced backyard to identify marijuana plants. And the Supreme Court said in the Cirallo case that any member of the public in this airspace who glanced down could have seen everything that these officers observed. And they talked about what was visible to the naked eye. So they were talking about people not having a reasonable expectation of privacy in their backyard from the air in this particular kind of manner. And you need a reasonable expectation of privacy. You need to show that in order to show that the police need to get a warrant or comply with the search and seizure requirements of the Fourth Amendment. Now, there's another case that the Supreme Court decided called Florida versus Riley, which came to the same conclusion as Cirallo. But in that case, the officers saw marijuana plants in a greenhouse. They were in a helicopter 400 feet above, and they used the same rationale as Cirallo. But in Kylo versus United States, it wasn't a question of looking in someone's backyard, but it was a question of the police using what is called a thermal imaging device. They don't actually touch the house. They can do it from actually away from the house, and it measures the heat waste emanating from the house. So, for example, if there is an inordinate amount of heat waste that one would expect, then maybe they could be growing marijuana plants. And so they were trying to detect whether or not there was an operation growing marijuana plants in the Kylo house. And the Supreme Court said that that constituted a Fourth Amendment search, that there was a reasonable expectation of privacy, and police should have gotten a warrant. And Justice Scalia wrote for the majority, uncharacteristic majority, and he said that if the government could freely collect any information emanating from a house, we would be at the mercy of advancing technology, including imaging technology that could discern all human activity in the home.
And so that implies that, Marjorie, that if the Supreme Court is ruling in this manner on technology that seems related and similar to drone technology, that it's very likely that if the use of drones were to be legally challenged and reach the Supreme Court, that would be regulated as well. But in the meantime, states like North Dakota are purchasing drones and have legalized drones, even if about half of other U.S. states have decided to regulate them. My guest is Marjorie Cohn. She's a professor of human rights at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She's also past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and she's edited the book Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. She just recently wrote an article about a very frightening future where drones could be deployed with so-called non-lethal or less than lethal weapons. So, Marjorie, you were just saying about the Supreme Court ruling on a technology that sounds similar to what drones might be seen as. And so what are the implications for drones?
Yes, and one of the things that Justice Scalia was concerned about in this thermal imaging case was that eventually the police would be able to see inside the house. Now they can just kind of see shadows. But one of the things that Scalia said is they could see the time of the day that the lady of the house took her sauna, which since all of us have saunas. But the thing that the Supreme Court was concerned about in that case was that this thermal imaging device was a device that is not in general public use. And given the fact that police drones will be able to and can conduct long-term surveillance with imaging systems that pick up much more detail than the naked eye, it is possible that the Supreme Court might follow this case, the Kylo case, and say that drones are somehow different than fixed wing aircraft and helicopters. But again, that is down the line, and this case would come to the Supreme Court likely if one of these bills, the one in the House or the one in the Senate or a different bill, were to pass and requiring the use of warrants, and then the government were to appeal. And the Supreme Court could review and decide whether or not warrants should be required for police before they can use drones for surveillance.
So I imagine also there are issues with what people might want to do if they see a drone above them and try to, you know, fight back. Imagining what I would do if I was in my home in my backyard and I saw a drone approaching me with, you know, a camera or something even more sinister, my first instinct would be to try to knock it down. It's not a person, so I would, you know, try to hit a stone or throw a rock at it or some other projectile would be really tempting. But you write that someone actually did try to do that in San Diego and got thrown in jail for it. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes, this guy's name is Augustine Lajeca, and he was on a San Diego beach with friends enjoying the beach when a drone flew above them. Its blades were whirring, its camera was rotating from side to side. And he said, "We had like a peeping Tom. I felt threatened." So Lajeca just took his T-shirt and threw it at the drone. It was low enough that his T-shirt hit the drone. The drone fell to the ground, and he was charged with felony vandalism. The drone operator was not charged. He claimed that the drone was worth $750. And Lajeca was released. He was spent the night in jail. He was released on $10,000 bond, and he was released without charge. But interestingly, when the Encinitas, and this is a city in northern San Diego County, when the Encinitas City Council met to talk about regulating the use of drones after this incident, there was a man, John Heron, who urged council to take action. And he said that his 3.5-year-old son had been terrified by a low-flying drone. And he said, "Once my son saw the drone, he became visibly scared. He told me he wanted to leave the park." And this really reminded me of how children in Yemen and Pakistan and Iraq and Syria and Somalia and Afghanistan feel when drones are surveilling for hours at a time. These predator drones can stay in the air many hours at a time. this is discussed in my book, Drones and Targeted Killing, but there is a report called Living Under Drones that was put out by the Stanford and NYU law schools, and it found that these drones are terrifying to people. And in fact, Medea Benjamin, who wrote one of the chapters in my book, interviewed people in Waziristan, Pakistan, and she said many of them live in a state of constant fear. They had a hard time sleeping. They suffer from depression, post-traumatic stress disorder. They use antidepressants, anxiety medication, and there's a spate of suicides that they didn't see before. And this is what's happening with impunity. We don't hear about this. We hear about the so-called militants that are killed by drones, but we don't know that, in fact, many of the people killed by drones and terrorized by drones, billions, and in fact, the book also talks about why killing people off the battlefield with drones is also illegal. It makes the president judge, jury, and executioner. It violates due process.
So finally, Marjorie, sadly, the issue of drones does not become something most Americans concern themselves with when it's just affecting those people over there. But when it comes time to us having to deal with it here in the United States, a lot of people get up in arms. What needs to happen? What are some of, you mentioned there were bills pending to regulate drones. Is there support in Congress for saying, not only should we not be allowing, you know, drone technology to, do anything other than perhaps deliver packages, and even that is problematic here in the U.S., but also be used abroad?
Yes. Well, there are bills pending, but keep in mind that the congresspersons get a lot of pressure from drone manufacturers, from law enforcement, saying that, we need to be kept safe. So there is some pushback, but both of these bills that are pending currently, and there could be others as well introduced, would require search warrants and also would regulate the private use of drones as well. And at least some of this legislation would regulate the private use of drones. But the FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, came up with some proposed regulations of drones earlier this year. They wouldn't be allowed to fly over people's houses unless they were directly involved with the flight. There are height and weight limits. The operator would have to maintain eye contact with the drone at all times. The problem is that this is going to take years to implement. And meanwhile, it's kind of a Wild West situation out there. People using drones, the FAA reported 700 near misses between airplanes and drones in U.S. airspace. And some of the drones have flown as high as 10,000 feet or more. So they're dangerous. They're interfering with firefighting. I'm not saying there aren't good uses for drones, finding missing persons, photography drones, but they need to be regulated. And in particular, the police must be required to use warrants before using drones for surveillance because they entail such a significant invasion of privacy.
Marjorie, I want to thank you so much, as always, for joining us. We'll post a link to your article from our website, uprisingwithsonali.com, later today. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
Marjorie Cohn is a professor of human rights at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She's also the past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and her book that she just edited that discusses a lot of these issues on drones is entitled Drones and Targeted Killing: Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. This is Uprising. When we come back from break, we'll talk to a woman whose relative has been behind bars in California prisons for decades, and worse, within solitary confinement. And we'll discuss what is new on the issue of solitary confinement. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Activists are celebrating a major settlement in a federal court over the use of solitary confinement in California prisons. After years of drawing attention to the brutal and torturous practice of indefinite isolation through life-risking hunger strikes, inmates won a partial victory. California prison authorities have relied on solitary to separate prisoners and as punitive measures, despite a large body of evidence against it. Thousands of prisoners are kept in tiny, sometimes windowless cell rooms for days, weeks, and even months. There have been hundreds that have spent over a decade in such unimaginable conditions. My guest is Cruz Gallegos. She is a member of California Families to Abolish Solitary Confinement. Her brother is an inmate who's been in solitary confinement. She now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising.
Hi.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, tell us about your brother, who he is and what conditions he has been under for years.
My brother's been incarcerated for 30 years. 26 years of those 30, he's been in a SHU cell. He's been housed in SHU for 26 years and in Pelican Bay. He was moved, he's just transported to Tehachapi prison, and he's been there since May. And
30 years in prison, and out of those, the majority held in solitary confinement. It's hard for anybody to imagine spending a week in such conditions, and your brother's been in those conditions for 26 years?
26 years.
Why? What was the reason given to hold him in such conditions?
He was told that he was a threat, that somebody anonymous said that he was a threat to prisoners, and that's why he was housed in SHU, and was to remain there for 6 months, and then later 3 years, and then later he was told 5 years, and eventually they just said he has to debrief in order to get out of SHU, which...
What does that mean, to be debriefed?
To tell on others, to be a snitch.
Have you had any connection with him or able to talk to him by
phone?
Oh,
yes. Mm-hmm. No, not by phone, in person.
In person, so you can go and visit him.
It's always behind a glass.
And the rest of the time that he has spent, he cannot interact with other prisoners?
No.
What has that done to him?
Because he's had family and someone always writing, visiting him, he's got a strong relationship with us, with his family. And I think that's helped him to remain sane, and he's had a lot of love from us and constant communication, which I know a lot of inmates that don't have that, and it does affect them. I think the only way it's affected my brother is just it's hard to see it in him if it has. I know that now that he's been transferred to this new prison, he does say that he's able to go out now to fresh air. But it's in a cage.
Still not interacting with...
He does. He talks to other prisoners now. After 26 years, he's able to talk and not get in trouble for talking to another fellow inmate. And he works, he does his workout, his routine in a cage, along with other inmates who are like in a row. I believe there's 13 inmates working out at the same time. And he's able to talk to them. He's able to see to feel the sun, the air, which he went without for 26 years.
So not only, of course, does that physically debilitate you when you don't have direct sunlight for so long, it also the psychological impacts are pretty severe. Psychologists have studied what solitary confinement does to people and found that it really is equivalent to torture, because what makes us human is not only being able to talk to one another, but even just the human touch.
Right. I know he tells us that what he notices is now, and I see it in a visit, it's still behind glass, that he's very sensitive to noise, to loud noises. If we're talking, he thinks we're talking too loud, and I don't think we're talking loud. And when he's outside, he says he has to keep turning around and see who's behind him. He hears people's voices, and he has to turn around and see where's the noise coming from. So he's constantly looking behind, and he's working on that because he notices that that's something he has to work through to, because it's not normal.
So to be kept for 26 years away from the company of other human beings, wow.
It was heartbreaking the day, the first visit we had here at his new prison when he's able to have a cell with the window. So he was very excited to have that window cell. And he says he was at night when it got dark, he was looking out the window and he was, I guess there was a tree and he was trying to see what he can see outside that window. And he says, for a while I kept staring. I didn't know that was what I was looking at. It was the moon. He hadn't seen the moon in so many years. He didn't recognize it at first. And he found that like, wow, that's the moon. And when he was telling me and my sister, because we were at a visit, he was telling us that story, and we cried because it's like, it's so unfair. I'm happy that, you know, this September 1st, the victory they had with
the settlement.
The settlement. It is gonna, he has a chance now to get out and to visit where we can hug and touch him. And I try not to get like this, but you know, I'm happy. I'm happy it's finally here. I've waited so many years for this. 26 years for him to, I thought he was never gonna get out of Pelican Bay. I thought if he did get out, it was gonna be in a box when he's dead. And I used to think it's so unfair. Why are they gonna let him go after he's gone? But I'm happy, but at the same time, when I think about, it reminds me of all the suffering, all the, what he went through, 26 years of loneliness, not having somebody to touch or somebody to caress him or give him any kind of affection, because that's not allowed. And no phone calls. And things are, I'm glad for the change, and I'm excited, and I'm happy, but like I said, it reminds me of all the pain that he's gone through, and we have gone through as his family, because we miss him, and especially on holidays, when on Mother's Day, because I know he was very close to my parents, and as time throughout those 26 years, they got ill. They became ill and they passed away. And during their illness, we tried to get him transferred to a closer prison because my parents couldn't travel. They were too sick. My mother was on dialysis. My father had cancer. And we got letters from several doctors proving that my mother was ill and she couldn't travel. And can they please transfer him to a closer prison? And they wouldn't do it unless my brother would debrief. And there is, he does have the right for a hardship transfer, but he was denied several times. And that's what's so wrong from the prison. And it happens all the time.
So your brother was held for the majority of his time at Pelican Bay State Prison. It's one of the worst offenders of the use of solitary confinement. They apparently have had 1,100 people in solitary. And at Pelican, the cells don't have windows.
Right.
But it was also at Pelican where these incredible hunger strikes took place, starting in 2011, repeatedly over several periods of time, that also catapulted the issue of this terrible practice of solitary into the national consciousness and even got a lot of international coverage. Did your brother participate, as far as you know?
Yes, there was 3 strikes that he participated in. I know the first strike he did was... he didn't eat for 26 days.
Wow.
And the second strike, he didn't eat for 20-something days. And the third one, it was less days that he didn't eat. But that's because he has a blood disease called hemochromatosis, where he has to get his a phlebotomy. They have to wash. I don't know how to explain it, but they clean his blood out. And they denied him that treatment because he was participating in the hunger strike. If he doesn't have that treatment, it would affect his heart. and his liver. So it's very important that he would have that treatment. So they gave him a choice: either you continue on this hunger strike, or you don't get the treatment. And that's why he ended after the 26 days, I believe, the first time.
So this particular decision, it's a legal decision. And so obviously there were a lot of lawyers involved that have donated their time and worked really hard to make this happen. Yes. But how much impact do you think those hunger strikes had on pushing this and sort of shaming California for what it's doing?
The hunger strikes worked in some way, but I think the way it really made an impact was families. People
on the outside.
We are their voices. It's very important for us to let the world know, the public know, what California prison is doing, how they treat their prisoners, how it's they're torturing them. And it's through people like this organization that I belong to, California Families Against Solitary Confinement. We're out there voicing for them. We're telling people what is going on. And yes, the hunger strikes, of course, did, because that was horrible for them to go through. But we still need a lot of work. We've come a long way, but we need more people involved, more family members. There's a lot of prisoners with family. And these prisoners in SHU, the family members should participate and make more. We need more people.
So the settlement, as far as I understand, would essentially now not allow for solitary confinement to be used as a tool to get people to snitch on one another. These sort
right.
of, if someone is just randomly identified as being in a prison gang, that used to be that a solitary
right.
was a punishment, so they can't use that anymore. Is that as far
That's
as
correct.
You know? And so they can also not allow the use of indefinite solitary confinement.
Correct. That's the victory.
The main victory that prisoners would be put into these cells completely isolated and not know when it was going to end.
Right.
So which was what happened to your brother?
That's what the victory was, is they can no longer use other type of information like drawings or letters or their names or go by snitches. Or any other, they need hard evidence to put somebody in SHU.
Do you consider this a huge victory or just the start?
It's a huge victory. I think the start was when he got out of Pelican Bay. That was the start.
For you personally?
For me personally, to see him leave that place.
Yeah.
And to see him now. Now he's different. He's not, he's changed. He doesn't have that look, that serious look. Now he's vibrant. He's got a smile on his face and he's excited and he's so happy to know that he's gonna be out there. That he wants to be out with treated like a regular prisoner.
Yeah, we're not even talking about freedom, real freedom.
No.
Just being able to interact with other prisoners.
Yes, it feels like it's real freedom because it's like he's been alive but dead at the same time.
How much longer does he have to serve?
He's a life.
He's a lifer.
Mm-hmm.
So if all he can hope for and your family can hope for is for him to live out the rest of his days in as comfortable an environment as possible.
Yes.
And for you to be able to hold him and touch him when you go to visit him.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's rehabilitation to be able to touch families. I know California CDC says that the prisoners have rehabilitation, but I didn't see any rehabilitation these 26 years. There hasn't been. Because if he hasn't had a touch from another human being or to spend time with family, there's no rehabilitation. And now the little that he's had with us, because it's different from the previous visits in Pelican Bay, where he's at today, there's no phone. We don't have to talk behind, it's glass and behind a phone at Pelican Bay. Here, it's open, so everybody speaks at the same time. So it's like a group visit.
It's human.
Yes, so that's closer to being in a circle with family. and I can see it in his eyes. I can see it every time I go see him, he's different. He looks happier. There's another look in his eyes. He's got color in his skin because he was pale. He was like sea transparent.
Because of no exposure to the sun.
And now he'll come to the visit and say, "Do I look like I have a tan?" Because he's so proud of a tan. And I'm like, I stay away from the sun, and you want to be in the sun. But he's missed the sun for so many years, and now to him, he doesn't care. He just wants to feel the sun.
So this decision is impacting thousands of prisoners across the state of California. I understand that there's a hearing period, but it's likely a comment period with hearings, but it's going to likely be accepted by the U.S. federal judge. So it's when it's a formal done deal, thousands of prisoners across California will see a real change.
Yes, we're hoping for that.
Well, Cruz, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us and wish you the best of luck.
Thank you for having me and be able to continue being their voice.
Is there a website you'd like to give out for the organization?
The California Families Against Solitary Confinement.
And people can just Google that.
And yes.
Post a link to our website.
They'll be updated on everything that's going on.
Good luck to you and your family.
Thank you.
My guest is Cruz Gallegos. She's a member of the group California Families to Abolish Solitary Confinement. Her brother has been an inmate in California prisons for years, was at Pelican Bay State Prison for 26 years in solitary confinement. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Kiana Turner is our visual editor. She also helped with audio engineering. And Teddy Robinson is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Jonathan Alexander for technical assistance. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time.